I didn't really know what I was going to talk about this evening until I actually this afternoon read your interview sheets, and it got me thinking. So that's kind of the inspiration for the talk this evening. I'd like to talk to some extent about the quality of intention, which is the second aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, and without that, not much happens. In fact, nothing happens. I'd like to start by honoring our intention for being here. The Buddha says, reflect on your good deeds and celebrate them. And it's, it really takes an enormous amount of intention for an organization, the Albuquerque Vipassana Sangha, to make the decision to have this happen. Enormous amount of work that went into our coming together in this way. And also, each one of us had to essentially arrange our lives in order to be here for these days. Some of us coming from considerable distance, from Ohio, from Oregon, from Massachusetts. Leela, I think you left your job teaching yesterday afternoon and went straight to the airport. Is that right?
Sort of, pretty much. I went home and got my suitcase, but then...
Yeah. And then got on a plane and flew to Albuquerque via Las Vegas, Nevada, and arrived here about 3:30 this morning, you know, and then got up and started the retreat and has been essentially going through the day today with very little sleep. Leela has really stretched in order to be with us and to share her gifts with us. That quality of intention, I think, is really worth celebrating for all of us. So I'd like to share with you a couple of experiences of people looking at statues. It's just occurred to me that two accounts I know of people looking at statues have really moved me over the years. And the reason they have moved me so much is that the person going into the experience is a different person from the one coming out of the experience. That some change happened to these people as a result of looking at a statue. And I'd like to invite you, just by way of intention, you can either hear these experiences being read at a distance, holding it at a distance, or you can attempt to actually penetrate the experience, to go into the experience, or allow the experience to come deeply into you. So the first is the experience of Thomas Merton, the Trappist priest and monk. On December 10th, 1968, Thomas Merton gave a talk on Marxism and monasticism at a historic gathering in Bangkok of monastics from a variety of different spiritual traditions, including Buddhist monastics. And the very last words he said in his talk were, "And now I will disappear." And indeed he did. His body was found a couple of hours later, electrocuted in a bathtub. So he died on December 10th, 1968. And they found, after his death, they found a manuscript of a journal that he kept during his travels in Asia. And a few days before his death, only a very few days before his death, he had an extraordinary experience looking at some statues. That really it was a transformative experience. It might have been a week, it might have been 10 days. It's hard to really see the chronology. But let me read his experience to you. This is, he went to a place called Palanarua, for those of you who have been there, in Sri Lanka, where there are three very large statues, a seated Buddha, a reclining Buddha, and a standing figure that is probably Ananda, the Buddha's attendant. Palanarua, with its vast area under trees, fences, few people, no beggars, a dirt road, lost. I am able to approach the Buddhas barefoot and undisturbed, my feet in wet grass, wet sand. Then the silence of the extraordinary faces, the great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing. The peace not of emotional resignation, but of Madhyamaka, that is, the middle path, of Shunyata, that is, of emptiness, that has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. For the doctrinaire, the mind that needs well-established positions, such peace, such silence can be frightening. I was knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of the figures, the clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock shape and landscape, figure, rock, and tree, and the sweep of the bare rock sloping away on the other side of the hollow, where you can go back and see different aspects of the figures. Looking at these figures, I was suddenly, almost forcibly, jerked clean out of the habitual half-tied vision of things. And an inner clearness, clarity, as if exploding from the rocks themselves, became evident and obvious. The queer evidence of the reclining figure, the smile, the sad smile of Ananda standing with arms folded, much more imperative than Da Vinci's Mona Lisa, because completely simple and straightforward. The thing about all this is that there is no puzzle, no problem, and really no mystery. All problems are resolved and everything is clear, simply because what matters is clear. The rock, all matter, all life is charged with Dharmakaya, that is the essence of all being. Everything is emptiness and everything is compassion. I don't know when in my life I have ever had such a sense of beauty and spiritual validity running together in one aesthetic illumination. Surely, with Mahabalipuram and Palanarua, my Asian pilgrimage has become clear and purified itself. So, how is it that probably millions of people have seen those statues? How is it that Thomas Merton was able to see in the way he did and to come out of that experience changed? And then another person looking at a statue, this is Rainer Maria Rilke, the German poet. In 1905, sculptor Auguste Rodin hired Rilke as his secretary, and they became close friends, and actually Rodin had a very great influence on Rilke and his poetry. And what Rodin encouraged Rilke to do was to really see. And when Rilke said to him at one point, you know, I haven't been writing very much recently, Rodin said, go to the zoo. And Rilke said, why? And he said, look at an animal until you really see it. Take 3 weeks if you need to. And so Rilke began practicing profound seeing. And remarkable poems came out of that. And I want to share one of them, his looking at another statue. It's the same sense of amazement that Merton shares here, being jerked clean out of the half-tied way of seeing things. So he goes to the Louvre, and he sees a statue which is really only a fragment of marble, an ancient statue. It's basically only the torso. The head is gone, The arms are gone beneath the shoulders, are cut away. The legs have been cut off above the knees. The penis is broken off. So he's looking at this fragment of rock, and what he discovers is that it's more alive than he is. And so if you would, just some sense of his looking deeply and being changed by the experience. This is Robert Bly's translation, Archaic Torso of Apollo. We have no idea what his fantastic head was like, where the eyeballs were slowly swelling. But his body now is glowing like a lamp, whose inner eyes, only turned down a little, hold their flame, shine. If there weren't light, the curve of the breast wouldn't blind you. And in the swerve of the thighs, a smile wouldn't keep on going toward the place where the seeds are. If there weren't light, this stone would look cut off where it drops clearly from the shoulders. Its skin wouldn't gleam like the fur of a wild animal. And the body wouldn't send out light from every edge as a star does. For there is... sorry. This happens every time I read this poem. For there is no place at all that isn't looking at you. You must change your life. So how is it that Rilke can look so deeply and penetratingly into this old broken piece of marble and find it so alive, and to have that experience actually change the whole quality of his life, and to realize you must change your life? So the poet W.H. Auden tells us, we would rather be ruined than changed. And that's the tension, really. And it really has all together to do with our spiritual practice. In order for us to be free, some very deep change has to happen. And we would rather be ruined than changed. We resist it. So this, I was just thinking as I was reading the interview questionnaires, there are a number of people here who are sitting their very first retreat, very first Vipassana retreat, but there are quite a number of people in this retreat who have done a lot of practice, an enormous amount of practice, not only in this tradition, but in other spiritual traditions. And collectively, I think, we have practiced collectively hundreds of years. And I'm just, and I love being with you, and I love seeing you again, and I'm wondering, why are we still gathering like this? Why haven't we changed? And it really interests me. What is actually required for us to change? And I think intention has something to do with it. I'd like to share with you the another experience of someone who changed. These are actually my favorite words of the Buddha right now. So something big happened to this guy, this human being who sat down under a tree somewhere around 528 BCE, the year 528. He sat down under a tree in the evening, and when he stood up the next morning, something very important had happened to him. So important that we are sitting here, you know, in 2006 in Albuquerque, in October 2006 in Albuquerque, New Mexico, as an actually direct result of whatever happened under that tree. We wouldn't be here if that hadn't happened. It's a direct cause and effect. You know, in the book of Proverbs, they say, without vision, the people perish. And some kind of vision got started under that tree, which has been enormously enduring over 2,500 years now. And here on some level he's describing the essence of that vision. So again, if you can, go into the inside of this experience, or let it inside you. So I, bhikkhus, myself subject to birth, old age, disease, death, sorrow, and corruption. Are any of us subject to those things? Birth, old age, disease, death, sorrow, and corruption. Perceiving the peril in what is subject to birth, old age, disease, death, sorrow, and corruption, seeking the unborn, the uttermost security from bondage, nirvana. One, the unborn, the unaging, the undiseased, the undying, the unsorrowing, the incorruptible, the utmost security from bondage, nirvana. Knowledge and insight arose within me. I have done what had to be done. For me, freedom is unshakable. This is the last birth. All suffering has ceased. So this is the essence of the change that the Buddha advises us to go through. To see the peril in what is subject to birth, old age, disease, death, sorrow, and corruption, and to seek the unborn, the unaging, the undying, the unsorrowing, the undiseased, the incorruptible. And he describes to us exactly what we need to do in order for that to happen. You know, if we have the intention for that to happen. And again, this is another passage from the Buddha. He uses a dramatic... the Buddha tends to use very dramatic metaphors in order to get our attention, to kind of snap us around. And even though this language is very old, this is a very powerful metaphor. He said, suppose, bhikkhus, a person whose lifetime is 100 years, who would live 100 years, and they were to say to this person, come, good person, in the morning they will strike you with 100 spears, and again at midday, and again in the evening. Now, good person, you whose lifetime is 100 years, who will live 100 years, being struck daily with 300 spears, at the end of the 100 years will penetrate the Four Noble Truths not penetrated before, that is, will come to full liberation. Even if it were to happen like that, a person of good family, bhikkhus, influenced by what is of value, might well undergo that ordeal. For what reason? Unimaginable, bhikkhus, is the beginning of the round of births and deaths. A starting point cannot be found for the suffering endured from blows by spears, swords, and axes. But actually, O bhikkhus, I do not say that penetration of the Four Noble Truths is accompanied by suffering and grief, but it is accompanied by pleasure and happiness. I say, therefore, bhikkhus, to realize this is suffering, an effort must be made. To realize this is the origin of suffering, an effort must be made. To realize this is the cessation of suffering, an effort must be made. To realize this is the way to the cessation of suffering, an effort must be made. So, the Buddha is telling us, if we want freedom, if we want profound change, then all we need to do is to penetrate deeply the Four Noble Truths. And so what is curious to me, and I don't have any sure answers to this, but what's curious to me is what keeps us from penetrating deeply these truths, you know, once they're presented to us. My sense is that, I'm only speaking from my own experience, but my sense is that it's hard for us to penetrate deeply the noble truth of the fact of suffering because of fear and denial. We all experience denial. The great poet Isa says, "We stroll along the roof of hell, gawking at flowers." You know, it's very hard for us to actually allow the knowledge, the realization of the depth and profundity of suffering intrinsic in this existence. We don't want to know about that because it's unpleasant, it's painful. And so we stay in a trance, some kind of trance of delusion, because we don't want to open in that way. You know, and so the question is, do we have the intention? Do we have the intention to penetrate deeply the truth of suffering? Yes, there's plenty of happiness in this life. But the Buddha said that intrinsic in every experience is unsatisfactoriness, because everything is impermanent. You know, will we continue to invest our energy and our time and our interest in things which intrinsically must pass away, that will be lost to us? And then, what is it that might keep us from penetrating deeply the second noble truth, the cause of suffering? You know, just briefly, the cause of suffering, and I'm sure many of you have heard or read or seen this explanation dozens of times. In fact, some of you have heard it from me dozens of times. So, to repeat it once more, not that it makes that much difference to say the words. What really has to happen is that we have to be willing to go deeply into the experience, or to allow the experience deeply into us, in the way that Merton did, in the way that Rilke did, you know, in the way that the Buddha did under the tree. But to say the words once more, our suffering comes because we want what is pleasant in our lives, and we grasp for what is pleasant and try and cling to what is pleasant. And our suffering comes because we resist what is unpleasant. We try to get rid of it if we have it. We try to keep it away if we don't have it yet. All of us have that conditioning. And it's very hard for us to be willing to look at that. My sense is that it's harder to penetrate the second noble truth than it is to penetrate the first. Because it's a lot easier to say, well, my suffering is caused by my circumstances. My suffering is caused by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, or the political situation, the global situation. My suffering is caused by my lousy relationships with people, with my boss. My suffering is caused by the injustice in the world. You know, it's very easy for us to project the cause of our suffering outside of ourselves. It's much more difficult and painful, although finally much more empowering, for us to recognize that it isn't any of our circumstances that cause our suffering, none of them. That our suffering is caused by how we relate to our circumstances. So it's hard. It's hard to see that. It's hard to take responsibility for it. It's so much easier to put the responsibility somewhere else. New Mexico Taxation and Revenue Department are causing my suffering. Brian gave a talk in Prescott when we were leading a retreat there a few weeks ago, and I loved the words that you used, Brian, is that we need to develop a new relationship to our experience. You know, that's so easy to say, but it's actually very difficult to do. But until we penetrate deeply the second noble truth, the cause of our suffering will continue. If the Buddha's right about this, that that's really the cause of our discomfort the unpleasant, so much of that essentially, if you want to bring it down to one sentence, our suffering comes from resistance, from resisting what is. If the Buddha's right, then you can do all kinds of wonderful spiritual practices that will benefit you, but may not actually uproot your suffering. So you can make good friends with angels and have a very good relationship with the angels. You could do spiritual dancing and chanting. There are all kinds of really interesting practices that can happen, and they do bring benefit to us. They bring us forms of happiness and balance and calm and bliss and rapture. All of those are good things. But if you actually don't work on the second noble truth, if you actually don't, in a deep way, penetrate that truth and begin to actually shift your relationship to your experience, then your suffering will continue and you won't be free. So do we have that intention? And then the third noble truth is a really simple one. You know, once the causes of suffering have been removed, then suffering disappears. That's an easy one. The harder one is actually removing the suffering, and that comes from the fourth noble truth, our Eightfold Path. So there's a way in which, and I've seen it in myself, you know, I've been doing spiritual practice now for 32 years. Began in 1974. And doing them, you know, sincerely, those spiritual practices. And there's a way in which it can all get kind of routine. Oh, I'm going to go on another retreat. You know, oh yeah, I remember, I watch my breath, and if I stay with this a little bit, my mind will get a bit calmer, and I can expect pretty much how the cycle is going to go for those of us who have been in a lot of retreats. It can become a kind of habit or a routine. And I think that in order for us to penetrate experience deeply and to learn from it and to be transformed by it, to be surprised by it, to be blown away by it in the way that Rilke and Merton were, in order for that to happen, there has to be a different attitude than habit. We have to be hungry for freedom. We have to really want it. We have to be willing to have a quality of investigation or inquiry to say, what really is going on here? This is not just about watching my breath. What is the breath? What's really happening with this breath? Is it something solid and continuous? Well, maybe it isn't. If we look deeply, if we can penetrate deeply with our mindfulness, with concentration, we come to see that the breath is almost nothing. It's insubstantial. It's nothing we can rely on. No, and if we're willing to look deeply at all of our experience, we'll find the same things. We'll find, by looking at them, by investigating, by inquiry, you know, having that sense of being hungry enough to really look, we will discover that nothing in our experience, none of our experience is self. Not our thoughts, not our sensations, not the sounds we hear or the sights we see or the smells or the tastes. Not our emotions especially. You know, none of it is self. Awareness is not self. That understanding can really change our experience, change our relationship to experience. We can have a new relationship to experience when we know that there's no self having it. And as we penetrate deeply into our experience, we can also come to see that everything is impermanent, that that nothing lasts, that nothing can be held on to, that it's actually a crummy strategy to hold on to what is pleasant because everything passes away. And it's a crummy strategy actually to resist what is unpleasant because unpleasant's going to come. They can't keep it away. So we have these lousy strategies that we keep doing over and over again because we're so conditioned to do them, and that's what perpetuates our suffering. Once we penetrate deeply and to see that everything is impermanent, it's just automatic for the heart to let go, not to cling, and not to resist. So just on a practical level, what we do in this practice is, particularly in these retreats, is to cultivate two qualities. Now, and this really relates to the second noble truth. The first thing we have to do in order to free ourselves is to know what's happening. We have to be present. You know, and I've been enamored of a statement that I read in a book by Sandra Maitri on the Enneagram. She says that your spiritual maturing will depend directly on how much time you spend in real time, which is the present. And if we actually look at our experience, if we look clearly at our experience, we actually don't spend that much time in real time in the present, because the thought process draws us away into the past, which we believe to be real. If we're identified with our thoughts, the past isn't real. It's gone. Or we're inhabiting the future. We're projecting our minds into the future. The future doesn't exist. It's only a projection. And so the first commitment is to be present. You know, are we willing to do that? And what will it take in order for us to be present? Only by being present can you know what is real. Only by being present can you be aware of what's actually happening to you. And by becoming more and more aware of what's happening to you through mindfulness, then you can make a choice about how you want to relate to what's happening to you. You know, once you know, so just a little example. I pretty much don't eat white things anymore. I don't eat white rice. I don't eat white bread. I don't eat white pasta. And every time I come to one of these Catholic retreat centers, there's a lot of white food, and I'm just not used to it. And this body doesn't run very well on it. You know, it's really my diet has changed a lot in recent years, and I'm pretty comfortable with what has come. But I don't have any choice, as you don't have any choice over what gets put in front of me at the table. So I can either resist all those white, empty carbohydrates, or I can appreciate the wonderful smile, you know, of the sister as she gives me my food, you know, and feel gratitude and eat the food with gratitude. So that's just one little example. The choice is, okay, this is not food that I like. This is not food that I believe is good for me. I can resist it and suffer. But since I'm here, since I don't have any control over my diet, since I'm going to be here until Tuesday afternoon, it might be better for me to let go of the resistance and just eat the food. And that's what I've been choosing to do. You know, I see these little resistances come up. This is not what I eat anymore. You know, this feels like the 1950s. And then just let it go. It's as simple as that. So in order to see what is, in order to free myself in this particular situation in the dining hall, one, I have to see what's happening. So there's white food, and then there's resistance, right? So resisting what is unpleasant is what causes our suffering. As soon as I notice that there's resistance, then I have a choice. I can either feed this resistance by running a big story in my mind about diet and health, or I can let go of the resistance and simply accept. Does this make sense? So you have to know what's happening, and that is training our mind to be present and to be aware. And then you have to notice how you're relating to what's happening and making a choice about it. And it really, it's so simple to say, it's very difficult to do. But it works. It really works. It works in all situations. You know, the Buddha says at one point, all things can be mastered by mindfulness. All things can be mastered by mindfulness. By being aware of what is happening, and then being aware of how we're relating to what is happening. And so in our practice, what we attempt to do is to train ourselves to be present, to make the commitment to have the strong intention to keep coming back, to be aware of what's actually happening in the moment. To train ourselves to be present, to know what's happening in the moment. And then as we notice our relationship to what is happening, more and more to generate a loving acceptance to reality, to whatever is happening. So loving acceptance for the white food. Just one little example. That doesn't mean that we don't do what we need to do at times in order to change on difficult situations. I plan to vote in a couple of weeks or less than a week and a half or whatever it is. I plan to vote. I plan to act. But I also intend not to get really freaked out by whatever the result might be. So do you see? So there are times it's not about passivity, because that's very often the question that comes up around this practice. This loving, kind friendship toward everything that happens is not about passivity. It's simply acknowledging this exists without resistance. So that's our practice. Again and again and again, to keep coming back to know what is happening, to notice how we're relating to what is happening, to see if it's necessary to shift our relationship to what is happening. And that's it. It's as simple as that. It's no more complicated than that. You now have enough information to free yourself entirely. Really. In this particular tradition, there are no secret teachings. And there's no advanced practice. This is what we do from the very beginning to the very end of practice. From the very beginning of our practice to full awakening, to full liberation. We pay attention. We notice how we're relating to what's happening. We develop a new relationship to our experience. But in order to do that, there has to be strong resolve. There has to be a really clear intention. You have to know what you want. And I know many people come to retreats because they want to get calmer. And that's actually wonderful. And this practice will make you calmer. Tranquility is really one of the wonderful fruits of this practice. Some people come because they want minds that are clearer and more concentrated. You know, it will improve your golf game if you do this practice. And that's fine. That's wonderful. It's great to have concentration and clarity. Some people come to this practice in order to develop healthier relationships in their lives. And this practice will do that. It will actually help you to have more and more wholesome relationships in your life, especially if you take the entire Eightfold Path as your practice, including ethical conduct, the five precepts that we took together this morning. That's all wonderful. But just to say that there's more, there's a potential for far more. You know, what the Buddha was describing of coming to the deathless, to experience what is unborn and undying and undiseased. And if that sounds like some kind of mystery to you, just experience it directly for yourself. This is possible. This is possible. And so I think it's very important in terms of intention to be very clear about what is possible in this practice and to decide for yourself whether you want that or not. That's a form of desire which is actually wholesome. The desire for freedom, not only for ourselves, but for others. It means working with resistance and fear, because we all have it, and it all keeps us on a shallow level of experience. The willingness to see our resistance and fear and walk through our resistance and fear in order to penetrate deeply. You know, Rilke could have started freaking out by seeing this ancient fragment of marble shining with light and looking at him from every place and telling him he had to change his life. He could have freaked out and run out of the Louvre. Instead, he stood there in the fire of that light in order to be changed by it. You know, are we courageous enough to do that? Are we courageous enough to let our experience profoundly into our psyches are we willing to penetrate our experience deeply, it requires working with resistance and fear. Otherwise, it becomes another routine. Oh, another retreat. Krishnamurti, right at the end of his life, he'd been teaching for 65 years. Krishnamurti looked around at one of the big gatherings and he said, "No one has changed." And though Krishnamurti was an extraordinary being, he was the second greatest influence on me after the Buddha. Krishnamurti was an extraordinary being, but he didn't teach a method. You know, essentially he didn't teach people how they can free themselves. He was pretty free himself, not entirely. That hasn't been my experience actually in this practice. I've seen myself change. I've seen my friends and colleagues change. I've seen my students change in really deep ways. But in every case, you know, I could just go through that experience of one friend after another, one student after another, one colleague after another, and say, what is it? What was it really that allowed them to penetrate deeply experience in order for a major change to happen, the way Merton woke up 10 days before he died? And every time I can tell you it was a strong motivation, a clear motivation. The Tibetans put it beautifully. They say everything depends on the tip of motivation. So I think it can be very helpful for us actually to be really clear about our motivation in this practice. And may we all change in the course of these days. Thank you. Let's sit for just a minute.